Let's try this again this week. See if you have the right answer this time. How many of you like history? Raise your hand. Okay, it's most of you. It's better than last week where it was about half of you. Let's ask another question. This gets a little more tricky. How many of you like to read and study the Old Testament? That's less of you like to read and study the Old Testament than you do history. Which is always funny to me. Because you can understand the New Testament without the Old Testament, but understanding the Old Testament exponentially increases your understanding of the New Testament. And we're going to see that today. So we're going to put together history and the Old Testament in a really what I think is kind of a unique way. And you're going to hear me say something now that you don't often hear in church. Okay? Close your Bibles. Put them down. Close your Bible apps, those of you who do the swiping thing. Okay? And just sit back and listen. I need you to really listen. I don't want you to be like overwhelmed or off-put by how much information you're about to get. Because I'm about to just go poof and put a lot out there. But you really got to have your thinking caps on. You really got to just start connecting dots. You've got to follow the dots all the way through. So I need you to listen intently. We have King Saul, King David, and then King Solomon, and that's it. That's all you have that reign over a united nation of Israel. One country, one people in one land. King Saul, King David, and then King Solomon. And then the country splits. There's a split after Solomon, and you have a divided kingdom. You have the kingdom of Israel in the north, and then the kingdom of Judah, which also has the capital of Jerusalem, in the south. So you have Israel and Judah. Both kingdoms have a succession of 20 kings. All of the kings in the north are bad. It seems as though each one of them picks up on the sin of before and tries to outdo it. They're all bad. Most of the kings in the southern kingdom are bad, but there are eight that we think are okay, or a couple that we think are really good. Okay? So as God brings his judgment upon the nation, his people, which is now divided, it comes quicker on the north, comes slower on the south, because of the succession of good kings who in some way lead the nation into repentance. Assyria comes and destroys the northern kingdom of Israel first in 721 BC. But by this time, as Assyria has swept across the world, its landscape, it has really sort of drawn itself thin. And as they come down towards the southern kingdom, we know 185,000 Assyrian soldiers are wiped out. Okay? And it weakens them. So as the Assyrians see their weakness, they start to form an alliance with the Egyptians. They've come from over here. They're coming all the way over. They're getting weaker and thin, and then they have this really debilitating battle here with God, and they lose. And they form this alliance with the Egyptians. Now, the Babylonians realize that it's time for them to bring themselves out from under the shackles of the Assyrians, and they come and they attack. They attack Assyria, and they wipe out Assyria as a ruling empire. And as they see the alliance between the Assyrians and the Egyptians, the Babylonians come rolling across, and they're going to drive the Egyptians all the way back to their own land. You have nothing to do with the Babylonian Empire, Egyptians. Get out of here. And as they're wiping out the Egyptians and driving them back to Egypt, they stumble across Israel. Excuse me, Judah, Jerusalem. Okay? And they come in 605. They stumble across Jerusalem, Judah, and they make it subject to the Babylonian Empire. So they become subjects in 605. In 596, Babylon comes back, sacks and plunders Jerusalem. And in 586, Babylon comes back and totally destroys Jerusalem and the temple. Now, we have these men of acclaim that you know very, very well. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You might know them by their Babylonian names as they were changed, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But their names here are Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They are brought as captives back to Babylon. And they choose there to do something incredible, something we struggle with. They do not defile themselves with the Babylonian culture and the Babylonian ways. They do not give in to the culture and the pressure and the world around them. They choose to remain pure. They trust the Lord. They obey the Lord. And they're blessed by the Lord. And they actually become prominent figures in the Babylonian Empire. Daniel rises most incredibly. He is given the ability by God to know and understand dreams, visions, and he becomes the most powerful person in the Empire of Babylon, second only to the king. Which brings me to something that I found interesting, and I hope you will find this interesting as well. Okay, this is where it gets a little iffy, because you're not always excited about the same things I'm excited about. Okay? You understand in our culture that our government has three main branches. Can anyone name them? Judicial, executive, legislative. Okay? Executive, legislative, judicial. It's the way we really should think about it. Executive, legislative, and judicial. It's made up of all sorts of groups of people. You know that. You have the cabinet. You have representatives. You have senators. You have ambassadors. You have the heads of the agencies. You have police. You have agents. You have ministry officials. All sorts of groups of people in government. The Babylonian Empire was very, very similar in that manner, with all sorts of branches of government. However, they have maintained something that our culture and our government has forgotten. The two-tiered system. The Babylonians, and in their system of government, understood very, very well that what you cannot see is far more powerful, far more influential, far more real than what you can see. They understood it, and they implemented it into their system and into their groups. There's an interesting collection of counselors and advisors to the king, to the emperor of Babylon. These groups make up the emperor's cabinet, much like our president has a cabinet around him. That's what these groups do. Now, I want to break this down for you. So don't get lost in the weeds. Just pay attention real careful. We have something called the Khartoum. The Khartoum. Can you guys say Khartoum? Hey, that was pretty good. We'll see if you keep up the same enthusiasm and volume as we keep going. We translate Khartoum to magicians. They are counselors to the king. They are the ones responsible for protecting the sacred books, telling the hidden things, finding out what the hidden things are and explaining them to the king. They perform incantations for the king to accomplish spiritual things like healing. Okay? The word actually comes from the Israelites' experience with the magicians in Pharaoh's court. The magicians that Pharaoh brought up when Moses came in, when they were in Egypt. So they have an understanding of this word, Khartoum. And then we have Kashaf. Can you guys say loudly, Kashaf? Kashaf. Thank you. Bless you. Okay. We translate that, not to magicians, but we translate that to sorcerers. These are people who practice putting spells on other people, other nations, other armies. They cast spells to harm, to hurt, or to keep captive other people. And then we have the Ashaf, okay? Ashaf. The Ashaf are translated conjurers. These are astrologers. This is kind of a weird thing. These are astrologers who practice necromancy. So they are putting astrology and the calling up or speaking to the dead together. That is who the Ashaf is. This is sort of like the woman that Saul sought out to talk to Samuel and get advice from Samuel. And then we have the Gezer. Let's say Gezer. Gezer. Yeah, you guys are losing your volume. Stay with it. The Gezer. We translate that diviners. The diviners. They are astrologers who don't call up the dead or speak to the dead. They are astrologers who try to predict the future and bring some sort of strategy or maybe even some sort of comfort to the king of Babylon. And then we have the Chaldeans that we translate Chaldeans. That's the way it is right there in the word. They are astrologers primarily just looking at the stars, trying to understand world events, the movement of nations. But this is really specifically a regional thing from the very southern part of the nation of Babylon. We have finally, the final word you have to sort of play along like you're interested this morning. The final thing is the whole group of these groups, like their coalition, they're being brought together. The combination of them is called Kakim. Kakim. Or as we translate, wise men. The Kakim are wise men. They are the wise men. They are the ones who understand. They are the ones who see. They are the ones who look beyond. They are the ones who get it. They are the ones who counsel the king. They are the Kakim, or wise men. This term is used 14 different times in the book of Daniel to describe the cabinet that exists around the king, to describe those that he looks to the most for help in governing an empire. This is the word wise men, who are his advisors. Do you understand that Daniel chapter 2, 48, 4, 9, and 5, 11 tell us that he is the chief of the Khartoum, the Ashaf, the Gezer, and the Chaldeans? Daniel is the ruler over Babylon and the chief prefect of the Kakim, the cabinet of the emperor, the king of Babylon, his counselors. They all work for him, this captive brought from Israel, is second person in the kingdom of Babylon, and all of the king's cabinets work for him. He's their boss. He is not a magician. He is not a conjurer. He is not a sorcerer. He is not a diviner. He is not doing any of that, but he is their boss, and they are all responsible to him. They all report and answer to Daniel. They have the responsibility of protecting the sacred writings and the history of the nation, the sacred words. Words that have been spoken as counsel to the king, words that they understand have an effect on the empire, the world, as they know it. And here's the funny thing. The whole kingdom knows that Daniel's God is the one true God of heaven and earth. Everything that Daniel has said and done in his position there, from the Lord, in his position there, has come true. It has been wise counsel, great advice, unbelievable prophecy. It has come true right before their very eyes. They not only know this from experience, but they also know this from imperial proclamation. Not just once, but also in the kingdom Daniel is going to, but certainly in Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar makes some unbelievable statements about Daniel and Daniel's God. So they know this not just by experience, but by imperial proclamation. Daniel's God is the one true God. Daniel is in this position under Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar's son, and Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Now, Babylon is really a kingdom that centers around its central figure of Nebuchadnezzar. He's a prince when all of this conquering starts. He becomes king while he has conquered Judah and Jerusalem. And its very identity is wrapped around Nebuchadnezzar. And it starts to weaken or starts to get lazy and comfortable under Nebuchadnezzar's son and grandson. Now, there are two groups who don't like being underneath the thumb of Babylon. One of them is the Medes, and one of them is the Persians. They don't like being ruled by Babylon, but they themselves have been unable to free themselves from Babylon. So as the kingdom is becoming more comfortable, more lazy, everybody straighten up, let's wake up here. As the kingdom of Babylon is getting fatter, let's say, these two groups realize we need to form a coalition. If we form a coalition, we can conquer Babylon. And so they do. They form a coalition and they march into and conquer Babylon in 539 BC. So we're getting closer and closer and closer to the time of Christ. 539. The Persian Empire absorbs this coalition of groups, this Kakim, these wise men, these cabinet officials. Persia absorbs them, and they are made a permanent part of the Persian king's court. So now they move here from Babylon into a very significant and important and influential role in Persia, part of the ruling class. Daniel is actually made chief of three chiefs over the cabinet officials of these Kakim in Persia. This bothers the other two chiefs. They're jealous of his power. They're jealous of his prominence and his name, so they conspire against him, and you know the lion's den story. Okay, he survives the lion's den, but these two conspirators don't. They're thrown in there, and they meet their fate. Daniel enjoys great success and great acclaim, not only in Babylon under its three kings, but now in Persia under its king. Daniel's quite old by this time. We believe that he passes away 3 to 5 years after the lion's den. In time, the Persian king, as you know, allows the Jews to start returning to their homeland of Israel. He allows them to start rebuilding Jerusalem and the wall and the nation. While Israel is rebuilding, we're getting into some more modern history now, while Israel is rebuilding and gaining its independence again, far off in the west, we've gone from the east now, all the way to the west now, far off in the west is a coalition of Greek city-states, and they're rallying behind one person. What's his name? Alexander the Great. They come, these Greeks with Alexander, they come and they defeat the Persians. There's some bad blood between the Persians and Alexander the Great. The Persians wiped out Alexander's father, his uncle, had some bad blood here, and boy, Alexander comes with a vengeance, and he wipes out the Persian Empire. Alexander dies as a young man there on the battlefield. And his kingdom is divided between his four generals. And there's some sort of argument, some sort of prestige, who's the best, who's the ruler of rulers. And they start arguing between themselves. And one of the southern kings, one of the southern generals, defeats the other southern general, and one of the northern generals defeats the other northern general. So now you have this sort of divided Greek state between the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemies in the south. In the northern kingdom, Israel is under the Maccabean family. They're the most influential family in this Seleucid Greek kingdom. And the Maccabeans, you guys from Moody know this, the Maccabeans and Trinity, you know, Trinity's like this, you know, what can I say? The Maccabeans lead a revolt against the Greek Seleucids and their governor, Antiochus Epiphanes. And by the way, the success of the revolt against the Greeks at that time in Antiochus Epiphanes, the independence that Israel once again has from the now Greek Empire, brought about the temple dedication, the festival of lights, the celebration of Hanukkah, which begins the season, in fact, next Sunday. So next Sunday, what the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, are going to be celebrating, it's intimately tied to the Maccabean revolt against the Greeks under the Seleucid Empire, with the Maccabeans helping them gain their freedom. So now, Israel is free from the Greek Empire, and some of the Persians whom the Greeks had conquered see that the Greek Empire is weakening. And these Persians align themselves, so the Greeks come in and conquer the Persians, the Greek Empire is divided now, in fact, Israel has been able to free itself from the Greeks, and some of the Persians that have been conquered by the Greeks realize, hey, the Greeks are getting weak, and they align themselves, listen, this is very important, with a group of people called the Parthians. The Parthians, they have the same political system, the same culture. They even speak the same language because the Parthians used to come under the Persian Empire before the Greeks conquered the Persian Empire. So listen carefully. Much like the Babylonians took some of the Israelite nobility, Daniel, Hananiah, Asriel, and Azariah. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. much like the Babylonians took the Israelite nobility, and much like the Persians took the Babylonian nobility, the Parthians now absorb some of the Persian nobility, comprised of these very same wise men. The very same wise men. But the Parthians don't call them Kakim. They call them in Greek, Magoi, or in Parthian, can anyone guess? Magi. Are you following this? From one Israelite captive to the Magi nobility in Parthia. The Parthian Empire is very interesting. They see the flaw of having a monarchy. They see this flaw. They recognize it in all of the kingdoms that had come before them. They think there's something wrong with having a monarchy, with having the monarchy determine its own destiny. They say, this is not good. And so they decide to make these magi, these wise men, the king makers. We're not going to have family dynasties. We're not going to have interwarring family clans fighting for the throne. We're not going to have any of that. We're going to have the Magi be the kingmakers, the coronators of kings. Their duties include absolute choice of the ruler of the Parthian Empire, and then they are to counsel that ruler as the wise men have counseled all the rulers of the previous great empires. While Parthia is independent and self-ruled, even now further in the west, beyond that Greek coalition that lived a very short life, beyond that Greek coalition is a small band of outcasts from a small boot-shaped peninsula. And they begin to coalesce and they begin to roll across everything that Daniel had said, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. Just like Daniel had prophesied, including Israel, ruling and reigning over them all is the Roman Empire. Now, one of the Roman Emperor's generals, his name is Pompey. You've probably heard of him. It's a city, famous city named after him. Okay, he conquers Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem moves against the Parthian Empire. But he fails. Another Roman general, Crassus, reaffirms control over Israel and settled there, moves against the Parthian Empire. And he fails. For some reason, Rome can't quite defeat the Parthians on the far eastern part of the border of their empire. Rome puts Herod Antipater in charge of Israel to stabilize the region, but the Parthian Empire now doesn't wait for an attack from Rome. The Parthian Empire attacks Herod Antipater and chases Herod Antipater all the way back to Imperial Rome itself. Coincidentally, while this is happening, there's a very important assassination that happens in Rome. Caesar, Julius Caesar, is killed. Now, his general, Mark Antony, see, now you're starting to get slightly interested. His general, Mark Antony, brings a scorched earth policy. You are going to dedicate yourself to the Roman Empire. You are going to come under its rule. You're going to be so loyal or you're going to die. We're not having any more of this mess, Mark Antony says. And he brings as many of the lands and people, including Israel, under heavy, heavy Roman control. Heavy Roman subjection again. And Mark Antony establishes Caesar's nephew, Octavian, as the new emperor, and Octavian takes the name Caesar Augustus. Caesar Augustus. Mark Antony also appoints Herod Antipater's son, Herod Antipas, as governor over Israel, that region, and he calls him, Herod, king of the Jews, is the name that Mark Antony gives Herod. But even Mark Antony, with the whole Roman Empire now under heavy subjection, is unable to bring those Parthians under his rule. They remain independent. They remain self-governed. They remain very well fortified, and they remain very, very wealthy. Why do we go through this exercise? Why do we do this? Why do we connect dot after dot after dot from Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, Darius, and Cyrus, from the Magi all the way through to the Parthian Empire? Why are we connecting dots with Parthian Empire and the Roman Empire? Why are we connecting dots with Mark Antony, Herod Antipater, Herod Antipas? Why are we doing this? You've got to make a direct connection, a straight line between two dots, between Daniel being the chief of the Magi in two different empires, all the way to the Magi in a free, independent, and strong Parthian Empire. There is a direct connection between those two dots. It is their job, these Magi, to protect the sacred writings. It is their job to teach the sacred histories. It is their job to watch for and see the sacred prophecies come true. And you have to understand that it's their daily duty to study them all, to know them all, and to hold that information intensely as they advise and rule and counsel an empire. Studying and holding sacred many writings, but, and here's the key, all the way in Parthia, the most influential and most acclaimed of those writings were Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the most famous, the writings of their boss, their historical lineage, Daniel. The prophet that these Magi in Parthia considered to be, quote, their prophet. And they've seen Daniel's prophetic vision of successive kings and kingdoms come true throughout the history as it's been laid out to them, verbatim and in great detail. Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Darius, Cyrus, Persia, Alexander the Great, the split between the four generals, the solidification of two Greek states, and then an empire unlike anything that the world had ever seen before, as Daniel had said. So what you literally have by the time of Caesar Augustus' proclamation, his declaration of taking a census so that all the world could be taxed, is a free, independent Parthian empire with the Kakim, the council of advisors, the wise men called satraps or magoi or magi, waiting for the next prophecy of Daniel to be fulfilled as precisely as all the preceding prophecies of Daniel. And what is the next one? What are they waiting for? What are they studying in the sacred writings? What are they looking for in their astrology? What are they waiting for? His next prophecy is a king. But a king that's unlike all the other kings that Daniel has spoken of. This king is not going to come from Babylon or Persia or Greece or Rome. This king is going to come from that little itty-bitty patch that everybody goes through, that everybody sort of finds by mistake. This king is going to come from the nation of Israel, and he's not going to rule for a moment or for a time. He is going to rule, as the word says, for eternity. And his kingdom is going to be righteous. You understand? This is what they're waiting for. Now, what's very interesting about this moment, as the Roman Empire is setting down in detail their history and their understanding of the world, they have a couple of historians. First one is Tacitus. The second one is Suetone. Tacitus and Suetone, in their writings, reference this distant kingdom that Rome has not been able to conquer. And Tacitus and Suetone, in their writings and referencing Parthia, talk about their ruling council. And what's weird or what's different or what's unconquerable about that kingdom is this ruling council. And both of them, in their writings, reference in sort of a satirical way the fact that those people over there in Parthia are looking for a king to come from Israel. This is actually in historical Roman writings. That is how they define Parthia. An unusual, unconquered group of people who want to ordain or coronate a king for themselves and for the world from Israel when they won't submit themselves to the Roman government. Now, let's talk about, briefly, who these magi are in Parthia. Unlike depicted in tradition, okay? And I love tradition. Tradition's great. Tradition is very important. Tradition was important to Jesus. Unlike is depicted in tradition, though, they are not three weary, tired, nomadic sojourners who cross the deserts on camelback and arrive at a stable. That's not who they are. These are Persian Parthian priests who study the universe, the movement of the stars, the movement of the nations, the movement of the sacred writings. They study the prophetic writings. They administer an empire that is unconquered by even the Romans. They counsel and appoint king after king over this strong and wealthy and free and sustained empire. They are crucial to the Parthian system. They are critical. They are valuable to their culture. They are, of course, very, very wealthy, highly admired, and because of their role as kingmakers, guess what else they are? Very well protected and guarded. No one is going to off one of these guys. No one's getting whacked. There's no assassinating these guys. They are well guarded as they administer an empire and pick king after king after king. And as in opposition to the way in which they are depicted, they disdain camels. They hate camels. They can't see camels. They think of them as loathsome creatures that make funny noises and spit. Okay, but you know what they do like? Arabian steeds. They surround themselves with Arabian steeds, and often they consider that the measure of their wealth. A breed of horses, by the way, that is perfectly capable of crossing a desert. So I want you to have this picture of who these people are. Who these people are. And this dot-to-dot connection between Daniel and them, and they call him their prophet. A group of priestly kingmakers, extremely wealthy, regal, heavily guarded by well-armed soldiers, traveling for 4 to 6 months, about 800 to 900 miles from the free, independent, unconquered, un-Roman-controlled area, coming into Israel on beautiful, strong Arabian horses in a company that would culturally have and traditionally would have had between 500 to 1,000 warriors. Now, what would that make our nativity sets look like? Okay, very expensive. Very expensive. Now, with that picture in mind, finally, turn with me to Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Remember what they did to Herod Antipater, Herod Antipas' father. Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, magi, kingmakers, from the east, unconquered Parthia, arrive in Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, gathering together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. And they said to him, "In Bethlehem of Judea. For this is what has been written by the prophet." Quote, "And you, Bethlehem, land of Judea, and by no means least among the leaders of Judah, for out of you shall come forth a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child, and when you have found him, report to me, so that I too may come and worship him." After hearing the king, they went their way, and the star which had been seen in the east went on before them until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And coming into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they presented him gifts of gold, and frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way. There are a few things that I want you to see, to take away from the text. First, Herod, who has been named by Mark Anthony, King of the Jews. governor of Judah, ruler of Jerusalem. He was greatly troubled. He was greatly troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Do you understand that this large, striking, intimidating entourage of highly guarded nobility marches into Israel from the free and independent empire that Rome has not been able to conquer, and they are the ones who had previously freed Israel from Herod's father, Herod Antipater, and chased him all the way back to Rome. Same people, same group, coming now again into Israel to Herod Antipater's son, Herod Antipas, and saying, "Hey, where's the king? Where's the king?" Herod is terrified. And the rest of the people are going, uh-oh. Their presence causes a great disturbance, fear, and trepidation. The second thing I want you to see is while these magi know intimately, the sacred writings and the prophecies, Herod is clueless. He has no idea. He calls the chief priests and the scribes just to get the basic information. So where is this Messiah supposed to be born? Just to get the basic. And also, while the Magi are deliberately, intentionally, willfully, and with great expense of time and resources searching for this king, no one else in Israel is searching for that king, including the priests and the scribes. Third, notice that this Herod, who has recently just killed two of his own sons, he has had two of his own sons killed, his own flesh and blood, because he suspected that they wanted to be king instead of him, is calling these kingmakers secretly and privately. When did this happen? When did this star you say you saw appear? When did this happen? How long ago? Which indicates he's already thinking to himself, well, how far back do I have to go? How old is this king supposed to be? How do I eliminate him to keep my kingdom? Fourth, they go to a house, not a stable. It's not a stable here. They go to, not a palace, they go to a house. And they find not a king on a throne. They find a child sitting with his mom. And these kingmakers, they fall to the ground. And they worship a child. They worship a child. And how do we know that their worship is real? How do we know that their worship is authentic? It's not just what they're doing, but it's also the manner in which they do it. We're given insight into their emotional disposition. They had rejoiced from their heart when they had found that house. In fact, the word that's used here, rejoice, is a word that we've studied before. It's a derivative of the word grace. They are rejoicing because they understand something has been given to them. They are rejoicing because they understand that God has given them a gift. They are rejoicing because they understand that this moment has been ordained, authored by God. They are rejoicing, exceedingly joyful, because God had shown them His grace. Finally, after they gift this child king, they receive a vision from God. And we are not told that it startled them. We are not told that it scared them or caused them fear and trepidation, as we are told of Zechariah, Elizabeth, Mary, Joseph, the shepherds. The one group of people in this story who hear from God directly and are not scared are these descendants of Daniel, these students of prophecy, these kingmakers, and they obey. They take their entourage and they go home another way. These administrative descendants of Daniel respect the text enough to know it, study the universe, and study the nations around them. They trust the text enough to seek out the prophetic fulfillment at the appointed time at great expense to themselves. They believe the text enough to receive it and rejoice and worship at the feet of a child in a house. And they honor the text enough to obey the same God that they believe gave it to them to begin with, way back with Daniel. One simple question for you guys this morning. Regarding all the prophecies from all the prophets, including Daniel, including words spoken by Jesus Christ himself about your day and your time and the alignment of the nations, who do you more emulate? Who do you more emulate? Herod? Completely and utterly unaware and uninterested? The priests and scribes? Somewhat aware, but apparently apathetic. Or the Magi? Do you emulate the Magi when it comes to prophecy? They were excited. They were watching, studying, searching, and rejoicing exceedingly with great joy.